December 17th, 2009, interview by Jennifer Frank with Dr. Judy Hollis, and this is the explanation.
Okay, Dr. Hollis, what I'm doing is my dissertation research on successful weight loss and maintenance. I'm doing a qualitative phenomenological study, so what I'm looking for is, it's called tacit knowledge, tacit knowing. Basically, the things that we don't know, we know, because my premise with this is that we know how to lose weight. We even know how to maintain it. But some people manage, after struggling, to get to a point where they can hold on to that. And a lot of people don't. So I'm investigating the people who are successful to see if I can get any sense of what flips the switch. You actually used that term yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't expect you to have that information off the top of your head. If you do, fabulous. But, you know,
yeah.
I have an interview protocol here, which is semi-structured. So, you know, the only question for sure I'm going to ask is the first one for the guidelines of the research. But it's a pretty informal conversation. I love the fact that you're a psychologist, because that means you've got a lot of experience with insight and self-analysis. And the information I'm looking certainly for some of the basics, like your history and how you got involved, how you got heavy, how you got slim, what the weight cycling was about, all that stuff. But over and above that, I'm trying to get a sense of what kind of shifts were going on that allowed you to get to the point where you were able to take it off and keep it off.
Great.
All right. So now I'm going to start my tape.
Okay.
And start the questioning.
I appreciate this opportunity, because you asking the question will get me to maybe come up with stuff I hadn't thought about.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. What has made it possible for you to maintain your weight loss this time around?
Well, I would say the most significant factor above and beyond all others is probably my membership in Overeaters Anonymous. I really feel that that has kept the motivation going. Other people's interest and support have kept me going at times I wanted to give up. So I think that's been very significant for me.
Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, like you said, everybody knows how to lose weight. I mean, it's ridiculous that nutritionists even try to tell us, you know, calorie counts. We usually know that we have the book memorized. So we know how to lose weight. We know what's required. But the motivation to hang in there when that part of me says, hell with this, and I just want that right now. I have found that other people's interest in me keeps me motivated to continue. I mean, that has happened for a long time. I don't know if it's as true as much today, 35 years into my recovery, as it was for maybe the first 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was very important, because when I thought I might like to binge, I thought of what I'd be giving up.
Which would be?
And I wouldn't be necessarily giving it up, but the that I would disappoint others.
Mm.
And, yeah, I didn't think I'd be giving anything up. But it just, another thing that motivated me quite a bit was my career, because I was, you know, traveling around the country and giving a lot of lectures and doing television, a lot of things. And I felt I wanted to be a clear channel, that I wanted to be sure that whatever messages were coming out of me were not sugar-coated or lard-laden. I didn't want to be kind of in a fog of a food fog.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times I was motivated out of but wanting conscious clarity.
Now, that puts my mind in two different directions, one of which is conscious clarity in the sense that you really would have some foggy thinking if you had a high carbohydrate spike going on. and the other that I'm not sure whether or not you were doing weight issues at that point, or whether, you know, and whether that was related to it as well.
Well, trust me, there have always been weight issues.
I mean, professionally, were you, like when you were on TV and when you were speaking, has that been your focus since the beginning of your career?
I'm sorry, what do you mean? Oh, you mean has that been my subject?
Yeah.
Or, I did, early on, I did some TV shows around women's empowerment. But after that, after my first book, Fat is a Family Affair, and the Oprah shows, it became that I was an expert in weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
But for me personally, the issue wasn't weight loss. It wasn't, am I going to photograph 5 pounds heavier on TV? It wasn't like that. It was what you said at first. It was about the clarity of thinking, that if I were lard-laden and sugar-coated, that I have not just foggy thinking and that I couldn't get my thoughts straight, but I would also be operating from a guilty place so that I was covering up doo-doo, you know, it's like I call it the cat dance, you know, in a sandbox covering up. And so that motivation of covering up feeling badly about myself, number one, and then also the motivation of obsessional thinking, like, when can I get out of here to get back to the cake? So those were all mindsets I didn't want to have when I was doing professional work. I wanted to be a clear channel, and I wanted to be authentic and present for the people I was working with.
And was that something that you realized as you were working or before you started working in the area?
I think after I started working in the area, I mean, I used to do therapy with families, and I would be sitting there, before I got into really dealing with myself, I'd be sitting there, and while they're talking, I'm thinking about what I had in the refrigerator, you know, drumming my nails to get back to my food. And after I got more clear of all the excess food, meal by meal, I started seeing what an issue it really was. I didn't know that before. Even though I worked in drug addiction, I helped alcoholics and heroin addicts, I didn't know that my food relationship was the same as their relationship with their drugs. You only find out when you stop. You know, I always say to people, if you want to find out why you're eating, don't. When you don't eat, then you find out. But as long as you're still eating, it's just a mind game, yada, yada.
You said a few minutes ago that the community effect was very powerful for you, that you didn't want to disappoint people. How did you develop the sense of community with the Overeaters Anonymous group?
Well, first of all, let me say that was a large factor, as well as this, what I just talked about, this seeking clarity.
Mm-hmm.
That was a new idea for me that I'd gotten in Overeaters Anonymous, the idea that there was a spirit.
Have your instructions with you?
Yeah. But anyway, it started recording now. It won't record over anything.
Okay.
So,
okay.
We're just listening here.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. What was the question?
I think I was talking about wanting to get a sense of how you developed a sense of community with OA that was helpful to you, that made you not want to disappoint people.
Okay, well, there was something about the message I heard at that first meeting. Nobody said it out loud, but I got the message, we know how hard it is, that we're all huddling here together trying to deal with this thing somehow, and that it's very big and it's very involved, and we'll try to help each other. And then I had a sponsor who, you know, knew what I was eating each day and knew my commitments, and it was about witnessing my commitment to myself. And so there'd be someone else who would see when I would break my commitment to myself. But in terms of developing a fellowship with OA, which is really highly recommended, I didn't do that, and I didn't like it. I didn't early on I tried going to lunch with people, mm-hmm. and I didn't like it. I just wanted to use that meeting as kind of my sacred space to take an hour out of my life to fully focus on this and try to gather up some supportive energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have any kind of a social network with mm-hmm. these people. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sociable with them at all.
What brought you to OA in the first place?
Well, you know, I worked in the field of drug addiction for many years, and people said, oh, you work so well with the addictive personality. I said, oh, thank you. And, you know, I didn't see my stuff at all. And then I was walking past the store window, and I saw a horribly fat woman, and I saw she was wearing my dress. And then it hit me that that was me, and I was very depressed about it. And, of course, then I started what we do, which is swearing off every morning, swearing off until, like, 3 in the afternoon I'd be binging. And then I went and I did a public talk at a local Y in San Pedro, and the woman there mentioned that she had just lost 30 pounds at Overeaters Anonymous. And I was shocked because I'd never heard of Overeaters Anonymous. This was 1974, and even though I was an expert in drug addiction, nobody knew about OA. They knew about AA, NA, Al-Anon. And I'd even consulted psychiatrists I worked with. Isn't there help for people like me? No, there's no help for anyone like you.
Mm-hmm.
But when this woman said that, I said, I think I'll go. I saw how AA was working so well for my patients. And I said, why shouldn't this work for me? So,
how old were you at that time?
29 and a half.
Oh.
Because I said, dear God, the next 30 have to be different. Mm. You know, whatever it takes, I have to do something different. So,
okay. So at this point, let's back up.
Okay.
And can you tell me your history of weight issues?
Well, I was obese all my life. My dad was a career Army officer, so we moved about every 2 years. Mm. And I got very close with friends, and every time we moved, it was just devastating. I had a pretty horrible family life with a lot of physical violence and pretty bad stuff. And so when I left my friends, it was like breaking. I broke apart, and I just ate to soothe and comfort that. And so I was already pretty fat. In fact, the weight I am right now is the weight I was when I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I was already pretty heavy all the time. And that was after I had just lost 30 pounds when I was 10 years old.
Mm.
So this is pretty much my set point, I believe.
Are you taller now than you were when you were 10?
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure, yeah. Yeah. So, so I tried everything. You know, I was a 9-time loser at Weight Watchers. I lost every time I went, and I did the HCG shots, you know, you stick pregnant urine, you give yourself a shot in the butt, and then you also eat 500 calories a day. So, you know, what makes you lose the weight? It's interesting. And then I did Atkins and Stillman, all those different diets in the 70s, and Air Force diet, cabbage soup diet, any kind of diet. And that was pretty much it. So it was just.
How old were you when you started dieting?
Oh, probably about 9.
Mm.
I've read that the average age now is about 8 that girls start dieting and obsessing about their weight.
Yeah.
I was probably 9. Then it just went on forever and gaining and losing, gaining and losing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, just like everyone else, every time, gained back just a little bit more than you had started. So when I hit 200, I said the dryer is shrinking my clothes. And when I hit 215, I said the scale must be broken. So my top weight was 222.
And what are you now?
I'm about 155.
And how tall are you?
5'4".
Okay.
Very muscular legs.
Uh-huh.
So I don't appear to be as heavy as I really am. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a lot of packed, solid weight.
Mm-hmm.
so.
Dancing and riding your bike.
That's right, yeah. I exercise. Now I just started a gym, so.
Was your family heavy?
Yes. Both my parents were obese. My dad eventually lost his weight. My mother stayed fat.
What was the attitude towards food in your family of origin?
It was always pretty much, you know, to be worried about it and to be on a diet of some kind. My dad was always on high-protein diets, as I recall, when I was growing up. And it was always, and my mother was always saying, oh, I really shouldn't be eating this, and then go ahead and eat it. But it was never done with relish, like, by God, I want to really enjoy this and I'm going to eat it. It was always somehow we're going to pay the piper and it's
trouble with guilt.
Yes. Big time, yeah. Yeah, in fact, part of what I teach people about today and what I do is really enjoying and savoring food.
Mm-hmm.
I teach the divine dine where I really want people to suck it dry. I love food and I want to get every morsel really good.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't believe in any of that. And if you're going to eat whatever it is, eat it and enjoy it and get back on the horse and move on. You know, not to be eating like with all that guilt. It's just not worth it.
So how long did you struggle with your weight?
Well, you know, I started 8 years old and I was fat all during my teen years. I never dated really, or except for low life guys. I was always heavy. I did get down to this weight when I met my first husband and then married him, who was an alcoholic, and it was with him that I just put on the rest of that weight back again plus and got up to my highest. And then I got into OA, and he eventually died of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. He tried AA. It didn't work for him. So that was a sad story. But there was a real juncture at that time when I said, his trolley is on a downhill path, and I'm going uphill, and I have to make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
If I follow him, I'm going down.
How do you think you came to that understanding?
Well, a lot of it, I think, was all my exposure to 12-step groups, you know, to AA and I was also in Al-Anon, you know. After I was in OA for 6 months, my husband lost his job due to his alcoholism. That immediately slam-dunked me into Al-Anon. And so I had been fed a steady diet of this kind of information for years. And I saw my whole milieu and people I worked with and everyone around me were into recovery. And it was very clear that I'd really be killing myself if I went back to that old way of life.
Mm-hmm.
That I had to separate from him.
There's a similar experience in my history about you can drown together or you can save yourself.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you were surrounded with information.
Yes.
That sounds like it seeped in and it seeped in and you got to a point of saturation.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it became a part of me.
Uh-huh.
It was no longer someone else saying it, but it was my credo as well. It was clear. I remember the time when, you know, when I decided to leave him. I don't know if that's the kind of stuff you want on the tape, but I was in a Gestalt training class for Gestalt therapists, and you know what we did is we did therapy on each other. And my husband had just beat me up the night before. I was also being beaten in the marriage, and he beat me up the night before the group, and then I went into the group, and so I was working, and I was crying, and telling this woman how I couldn't get him to leave the house. I had to hold on to the house because I had a guest house in back, which was my office for my clients, and I still had a steady job. I could pay the mortgage. Why wouldn't he leave? I was going through that scenario, and she said to me, well, there'll always be something. And it was like chapel bells went off. I said, wow, yeah, there's always a good reason why you stay in an abusive situation. Everybody's got a good reason. And I'm saying, so my clients won't be inconvenienced? So go rent an office. I'm saying, because I don't want to lose the house? Lose the house, you know? Get out. So it was very clear. And it's another thing that kept reinforcing me to stay with a good food plan, because bong, your body tells you, wow, such clarity that you can take action because your body is aligned with your psyche. You know, you're not disjointed because of sugar, carbohydrates, or whatever.
So you're not numbed.
You're not numbed. That's it. Yeah. So it was very clear to me, and you know, that the next day when he got back, I said, Howard, one of us is leaving today. If it's not you, it'll be me, but I can't do this one more day. And he said, okay, I'll leave, and you know, that started a series of events. But that clarity and that power of being able to quietly take very decisive, powerful actions, quietly, with love and respect, but setting up your own boundaries. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be hit anymore. All of those things I got from having my food in order.
Okay. This is exactly the kind of thing that I want to explore.
Great.
And I love the way you're putting it. You're very clear about it.
Mm-hmm.
I probably will come back to that.
Sure.
Unless
because that is the essence, I think, of what kept me keeping on.
Mm-hmm.
Wanting that in my life.
That you had a sort of an epiphany. It became crystallized for you.
Yes. That you can operate with clarity mm-hmm. as an adult and be powerful and unafraid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that fear is a huge issue with people who struggle with their weight. Not, you know, of course, not universally, but many people.
Yes. Well, I often say, to lose the fat risk, you must live at risk.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I do. I live more at risk than other folks, and I put myself in risky situations to kind of approach my edge and test my mettle. You know, I travel in India and other third world countries without reservations and no fancy hotels, finding my way in the streets, finding little guest houses and living like the people live, because it awakens another part of me that really is more universal and bigger than this little place here in lovely Palm Springs, California. I mean, I love this too, but I want to explore more parts of myself.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot of meat in that.
Yeah.
And while you're talking about it, what's going through my head is, in a way, getting out of oneself. You know, getting out of the familiarity, trusting that the universe will work out if you don't take charge of it.
Yes.
But I can tell you that when you say that, I get filled with fear.
Really? Okay.
And I imagine that there are a lot of people who are not, you know, that if they're not like daredevil risk takers, you know, jumping out of airplanes and everything, that would also be a very hard concept for them.
Yeah, yeah. I understand that, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I tend to attract and am attracted to fearful people.
Mm.
when I'm so unafraid. And I'm not sure that I'm wise in being unafraid. I know that it's an overreaction in some ways, not wanting to be afraid, so I put on this other. But I rarely let myself feel fear. I just believe it's going to work out, and usually, so far, so good. I've been in dangerous situations that I've come out of okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't do bungee jumping, and I don't do parachuting. There's certain things
It's not the adrenaline effect you're after.
No, it's not. It's the bigger picture of yourself and life. You know, we volunteered in Burma a few years ago and lived in a monastery, sleeping on the floor with the monks, with rats running around our head, because other people do it. If these people in Burma can live this way, Why can't I? Because I was born American? You know, it's like I want to experience how everybody lives. And, you know, there's a phrase, nothing human is foreign to me. And that can mean, you know, that I can sleep on a floor with rats, but it also can mean I could be Jeffrey Dahmer. And if I don't explore and know that I have a dark side, in fact, my new book, From Bagels to Buddha, is all about that. You know, trips to Burma. Yeah, the, you know, trips to Burma, but also owning my own dark side and finding a way to live with how bad you can be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to accept yourself at your worst and keep on and value yourself enough, you know.
So how do you do that?
Well, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time staying honest.
Mm-hmm.
Not to, you know, look at it 1 minute and then run away and pretend you didn't see what you saw.
Mm-hmm.
But constantly wearing it like a loose garment, carrying it that, yes, I did. What, in my case, it was that I was not present when my mother died. And I felt very badly about that because I sort of had a sense that it might be the time. And then I said, nah, not really. And it turned out it was. I mean, the doctors didn't think it was, and no one did, but I had a sense that could be true, and I didn't go to the hospital. And she did die, and so I felt like I was rotten. I felt I was the bad seed she had always told me I was.
Mm.
And it took a long time of staying guilty, of feeling badly about myself, of not talking to many people about it, a lot of writing, that's strongly suggested in OA, to write a lot of your work you need to do psychologically. And eventually it kept getting a little lighter and lighter. And then, you know, as you'll read in the book, it's because also some of the gurus I consulted in India gave me other feedback about it being okay. And the fact that Ram Dass wasn't there when his mother died, too.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you know that, but Ram Dass plays heavily in the book. And turns out he wasn't there either. He was smoking dope with Timothy Leary. So, you know. So,
I read a...
There's Henry.
I'm pausing it while that happens.
Okay. I got a pause. Okay, let me see. Yeah. Sorry about the pause. Henry stopped by on his motorcycle to tell us that he'd gone to the market.
And picked up?
5 or 1.
I heard Ram Dass, a taped lecture that he gave at, I believe, an AMA conference many years ago on Seasons of Our Lives. I don't know if you've heard that one.
I've heard nearly everything of his. I absolutely adore him.
It was a very powerful experience.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, I guess I'll put mine back on what you were saying about Ram Dass. And it's sort of hooking up in my mind with this fearlessness and with this being present in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the themes that I think is coming through for you, and I've heard it from other places too, is one of patience.
Yes.
You know, that nobody does this in a heartbeat.
Right, and everybody thinks you should.
Mm.
Our whole culture advertises how easy it is. But that's a very good point, and I've said that a lot too, that we're given this illness that really tests us on patience, because you don't get the direct result that, you know, I didn't eat today and I lost 5 pounds. No, it might be a week later, 2 weeks later, and, you know, it's never going to show up on your timetable. So you have to just start enjoying the process and the journey rather than the outcome. But if we're impatient, we're jumping on that scale every half second and nothing shows up.
And often to our own detriment, because if we don't get the answer we want, we're likely to
give up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And punish ourselves with some food.
Yeah.
Punish and pleasure at the same time.
Yes. That's in my second book, Fat and Furious,
there
a lot
go.
About that. Yeah.
Was there a point that you were resigned to living at a larger size?
Now.
That's very interesting.
Absolutely. This is the first time in my life that I've accepted that this is probably my weight and it'll be fine. But the whole 35 years I've had my weight down, it has still been, it should be at least 10 pounds thinner. I have lost about 15 pounds lower than where I am now. And I had a gaunt look, which I liked. But, you know, with menopause and whatever else and life, this little bit came back. And it's only been in about the last 2 or 3 years that I've accepted, well, if this is it, it's not so bad, and I can live with it, and it's okay. But I'm a lot more into function more than form these days.
Mm-hmm.
I want to stay active so that I can do the things I like to do. And as I'm aging, I know that's going to be a factor.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be better if I'm a few pounds thinner to get around, but what I would have to do to lose more weight right now is too restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to live in the world.
Mm-hmm. You still enjoy eating?
Very much. Oh, yeah. I love eating. I sometimes overeat. I find that what's supposed to be a normal portion for me, I think, sucks. I don't know who made these standards, but they're obviously true, because when I eat as much as I'd like to eat, I start putting weight on. But a half a cup of rice? Are you kidding me? What is that about? You know, it just, I like large portions, so that's why, like Susan Powder, I do mega doses of vegetables. I make humongous stir fries. You know, I do whatever I can to stay full.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am not, and you know, when I go to restaurants, I right away set aside half of the protein portion that I'm going to take home. I either have a baggie in my purse or I'm going to get a, you know, doggy bag or whatever. But I don't like doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have the whole thing, and I think I should. But everything I know says that American restaurant portions are too big, and I don't need that much. My body doesn't need that much. Even going to the gym and bike riding and swimming,
mm-hmm.
my body still doesn't need as much as I want to eat.
Mm-hmm. So that's a meal-by-meal struggle?
It's not always a struggle.
Uh-huh.
Not always, no. I'd say 95% of the time it's pretty easy. Right now it's a bit difficult for me in this particular stage of my life because, one, I was just on a cruise where I overate, so I've just had to take that weight back off,
mm-hmm.
gained weight. And then I have this star dedication coming up at the Walk of Stars, and I, like, very stressed with press releases and things getting ready for it. So so I've been hungry most days.
Do you experience stressless hunger? I mean, does it tend to spur hunger?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah, because the opposite isn't true. When I'm stressed, I don't feel like food's the last thing on my mind.
Uh-huh.
And there are people like that. When they're stressed, they don't want to eat. That is not me.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, stress. So, but I would say in normal times, about 95% of the time, food is not an issue for me. It's a pretty easy deal because I have a pretty basic pattern, and my pattern is okay by me, and, you know.
So you actually do consume a lot, but much of it is vegetable and low-calorie.
That's right, yes.
Uh-huh.
I eat mostly non-fat milk products. If I have carbohydrates, they're lower glycemic, like I have brown rice as opposed to white rice.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely have white rice. I have sweet potato instead of a regular white potato. Although white potato is fine. It's good for you, but it triggers me to want more.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain things I know that I have to be careful about. I rarely have white bread. But, you know, traveling in France this summer, we had white bread, you
sure.
know, of course.
Do you
know.
Try to avoid wheat?
Yeah, for the most part. You know what? It's that thing you said about enjoying food. I make a choice, is something worth it?
Mm-hmm.
If I really love it, then I'll probably have it, but then I worry, not worry, but I am wary about the results later. That
mm-hmm.
if I'm going to have some reaction later, I'll say, oh, that was because of that bread earlier, you know, that I'm a little shaky and wanting more.
Mm-hmm.
What it sets up is, I just want more. I'm not satisfied with just a little.
Do you have sugar in your
diet? Oh, yeah. Okay. I have sugar. I eat desserts. I have low-fat frozen yogurt. I do that at the little machinis. And I have some yogurt that's sweetened, but most of my yogurt isn't sweetened. There's just... Fiber One brand makes a key lime pie flavor.
Uh-huh.
And if you mix that with Fiber One cereal, it's just like a key lime pie.
Oh, wow.
It's nice, but it has sugar in it, whereas mostly I have low-fat plain yogurt, non-fat plain.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a piece of bittersweet chocolate here and there, you know, and if I go out to something where there's a really nice dessert, I might share it with somebody. If I go to a party, I sometimes have a cookie or two.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that I try not to have that cookie or two is because I want 22.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other people are happy to have a cookie or two, and I'm not. It just makes me a wretch the whole night because I want to go back over to the buffet table and grab more and more and more. So it's very often easier not to have any.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you manage your stress when you are in stress?
Well, like now I've just joined a gym. I go to the gym every morning. I just told the lady at the gym this morning, you know, she says, well, now we've got it out of the way or something. Oh, I go to this little class, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I have to do it to kind of frame my day because I have so much I have to achieve right now that getting that stress off lowers my... I always say when all else fails, lower your expectations. It helps me lower my expectations of what I'm going to accomplish that day.
Really?
That I'm not going to be able to do 183 things. Going to the gym helps me kind of get perspective about being a human being in this one body and how much can I really do in a day.
Uh-huh.
I can't do all that my head decided I should be able to.
And that also sounds like it connects back to this, you know, being in the moment. In a way, the risk-taking of just being.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you have a lot of things hanging over your head, you still have to be.
Yes, that's a very good thing that you just said. Because, you know, sometimes I'll be in the office all by myself. I'm my own boss, and I'll be hyperventilating.
Mm-hmm.
I work myself up into having so many tracks going at once, so much multitasking going on,
mm-hmm.
that it's almost like it's overload, and I go, gah! And my breath is just, I can see my breath. I say, what are you doing to yourself, you know? And you know, I'm writing this other book called The Binge Whisperer. And I'm using a lot of the ideas of Cesar Millan, the dog whisperer, and talking about how we can tame our inner beast.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an inner beast that wants to eat all the time. And, you know, one of his things is ACE, assertive, calm energy. And one of the reasons I joined this gym to do this class every morning is because he says you have to take the dogs out and walk them first, you know, so that they can be and you can be in ACE, assertive, calm energy. And if I can talk to myself from that place, it's more aligned with the results I want to have longer term than just this immediate reactive mind,
mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to walk the dogs first.
That's great. I see it as burning off the excess so you can get to the central.
The core, yes.
Yeah.
Very good.
What kind of support systems have you got?
Well, I have Overeaters Anonymous. I go to meetings. I have a sponsor in OA that I email. Well, right now I'm emailing my food plan. I don't always do that, but I do that when I'm in more stressful times and I want to just have some witnessing. I have a man who I live with who is very supportive. He's not judgmental. And he... you know, he's into health, he exercises and does his thing, and so that's highly motivating and supportive.
Do you exercise together?
Rarely. Sometimes we go bike riding together. Yeah. We do bike riding a little bit together. But I go to the gym, and he has his own workout gym that he goes to. So.
Friendships?
All. Well, yeah, I have friendships. However, it's very interesting. You know, this recent study said that what's most important is not your family or your genes, but your friends. Mm-hmm. That if you surround yourself with dieting friends, you'll diet, and vice versa. But just lately, I've been getting turned off more and more to my friends who talk diet so much. Mm-hmm. I like my OA friends, and I like my OA sponsor, but it's sort of like an American pastime to sit around and talk about dieting, and it just...
It baffles people in other countries.
Yeah?
You can do that?
Uh-huh.
You can talk about dieting for half an hour?
Really?
That's
yeah.
So weird.
Yes, I know. I know. And I have a book right over there on the shelf called Fatland, How America Became the Fattest Nation in the World. And as much as we talk about it, we get worse and worse at it. So I guess that's what's been turning me off, is how much talking we do about it. It just seems obsessional, and when I talk to friends who are into dieting, it just seems so obsessional, and also more offhanded. What I liked about OA is they took it very seriously. It's a disease, and we take ourselves seriously, and we deserve respect, and we have a respectful relationship toward the substance. Not fearful. Some people in OA get fearful around it, and that's not a message I like either. But just a healthy respect for this thing has been a problem, and we're doing something about it. But the kind of incessant, oh, I gained, I ate, I didn't eat, it's like, I don't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if in a way you've moved past the need for that yourself.
I think so. What I have moved past is the, I don't know if the need, but it's whether it's effective for me in any way. It doesn't do anything for me.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. It's just nonsense talk. It's chatter.
Yeah.
Now what?
Yeah.
I mean, all the talk will get us back to the same place. What are you going to do right now? You know, what's happening with the next bite? That's all that counts.
Yeah.
All the rest of it, trying to psychoanalyze my battered childhood and everything else. I've done all that.
What do you think people are doing when they do that?
They want to get control over it. If I can figure it out, then I will know in that situation I won't do, or I can stop this. But I've been at it long enough to tell you, you never get control over it. That there can be a moment that you say, what in the hell? Why did I pick that up? What was that about? I wasn't stressed. I wasn't blah, 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 blah. And here I am, walking at a party, and I just jab my hand into that whole bowl of nuts, and I spend the rest of the party walking around shoveling nuts in my mouth. Mm-hmm. And later on I can say, what the hell was that about?
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't matter to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
You did it because you have a natural tendency to do it. Our natural state is binging. Mm-hmm. Every day to the good is a miracle. Thank you, Jesus. You know? Instead of all this figuring it out. What's that going to get you? I haven't found it get you much. It's interesting material for your memoirs, and I guess that stuff did help me in the years that it did help me, you know, kind of on that exploration. So I don't want to judge, you know, anybody who's doing it now. It's just that it doesn't work for me anymore.
I feel like it's peeling off layers of onion skin.
Yeah.
That as you get closer to the core, it's less about having to think about it, more about the essence of being it. I do it or I don't do it.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And when you're more at your essence, all these external factors aren't as important as they once were, because when we were out here at the outer edges of the onion, we were more reactive
mm-hmm.
to external stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
So the external stimuli were important. But now, at the core, it's just between you and you.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's I don't know if you're psychodynamically oriented, but the concept of integration of self. And that sounds like what you're describing.
Uh-huh.
You know, that instead of splitting off pieces, to the hot fudge cake or to the 10 ounces of steak instead of 3, whatever, that you can pull yourself together, and that because you're together and solid, there's less of a tendency to go flying off.
Oh, that's very wonderful. Yeah, thank you.
Well, that's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're right. That is what I'm saying.
So that's, you know, that's, it's wonderful that you're saying that, because that's exactly the kind of thing I'm looking for.
Okay.
And it's also, I feel like I'm really, you know, getting a sense from what you're telling me about the process that you have gone through. And what makes it, what makes you different from the, you know, 80 to 98% of people who lose weight and then can't keep it off?
Yeah.
Depending on what statistics you're looking at.
So what are you saying makes it different? Like, what could be an ingredient we'd want to tell people to try for?
I'm hearing a number of things. Patience.
Okay.
Sort of personal integrity, pulling oneself together into a solid core. Being prepared to cope with wanting and sometimes doing. You know, one of the things that I hear from a lot of people, people who are successful go off the wagon, get back on the wagon.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
People who are not successful go off the wagon and immediately spin off the planet.
Right, right. You don't see them for 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is that about? That's like a license to kill. Yeah. Why should you assume just because you had a bad day that you stay out there for weeks and weeks?
Well, that's what's interesting about the difficulty for so many people. And I think there might be something in this about the integration of self, because if people are, you know, if they do 10 months of really wonderful work and they have a binge and they cannot pull it back in, something broke. You know, somehow that 10 months doesn't mean anything. You know, or at least it's not with them.
Right.
You know, it's not what's...
Or I think, you know, the things I described earlier about the good feelings that I had about making decisions from a conscious place and having good luck happen as a result of staying on the path, those things are very attractive and you want to go back to those. If this person was only about struggling and white-knuckling it and only bad, bad, terrible, terrible, then the minute they go off, they say, the hell with that, I'm going to stay off.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't see any good things that were going on while they were depriving themselves or eating.
Yeah, actually, that brings up something that I was thinking about when you were talking earlier about, you know, right around the time you were talking about traveling and taking chances and, you know, the sense of personal agency, that you're doing what you want to do, not what somebody tells you to do or what the voice in the back of your head says. You know, that the eating or the not eating is Judy's decision.
Right.
And you can take pride in it. You know, that it's really what you want.
And that's why people need to develop their own food plan that'll work on a daily basis based on their lifestyle and who they are. And instead of following one rigid guideline imposed from someone else, because then they can always rebel against the someone else's, and they never have that personal integration you're talking about.
Yeah.
Of their own integrity to themselves and their decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of research about impulse control problems with, you know, overeaters and difficult mood states and consoling oneself with the food and impatience, you know, no impulse control. But I think that...
Let's see, I want to ask, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I always wonder, what do those things do for us to know that? Like years ago, the National Institute of Health commissioned, they spent $3,000 to run a study of buffet behavior. So they had normal people and overeaters all go to the buffet, and they found out everybody overeats at buffets. Thank you very much. I mean, we knew this already. We knew impulse control issues. We knew in impatience issues. What do all these studies tell us? Like, how do they help us to, you know, to keep going? We each have to look at our own personal daily behavior. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like there's too much information out there now. Everybody's reading everything and saying, aha, this and aha, that. And for example, for years in the treatment field, it went around, and I saw this happening, it went around that everyone who's overweight must have been incested. Now, how did that happen? Because the insurance companies were cracking down on treatment centers and saying, this person better be more seriously ill than just they can't stop their eating. So, okay, the counselors went back and interviewed everybody. Do you remember anything? Hello, hello? And they could find something like incest, which no one wants to ask any further questions, right? And that became what everybody's reporting in their charts. Mm-hmm. And I would sit in staffings and the counselor would say, well, she's an incest survivor. I said, what does that mean? Well, I don't know. She just told me when on the intake that she was an incest survivor. I said, please go back and find out what that means. Comes back and reports, well, her dad used to sit in the living room with his shorts on, and someone told her that was incest. Well, maybe it was incest. You know, it depends how the person experienced it and what was going on in the dad's intentions and everything else. But it doesn't compare with the person who was raped by her parent or, you know, let's get more clear about this, you know. So anyway, so what I'm saying is then all these people were bundled together to then say, oh, you must have some incest even if you don't remember it. And I have patients in, you know, in groups trying to remember. What is that,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There's a lot of suspicious research.
Yeah. Well, all I'm saying is, for me as a person, as an individual, what good does it do me? Mm-hmm. It's very interesting, like this thing about who your friends are is more important than anything. Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I'll file that, and I'll remember it. But if one of these is going to be the key, no. They're all just interesting parts of the whole.
That's why this is a qualitative study. Because I don't think there is a key.
Good. Yes.
I think it's very individual.
Okay.
And what I'm kind of hoping for is that I'll see some similarities pattern, which I actually am seeing some.
Uh-huh.
But I still think that as long as it's someone else's idea, it's not going to work.
That's right. Absolutely. And I think coming up with the idea that it's individual is very revolutionary.
I think it's, I don't know, I think it's out there. Don't you?
I think it's, no. Huh. I see people, if it's out there, then how come everybody wants to do the latest new diet?
Well, because people are sheep.
So no one is really selling how much it has to be individualized. That's a very wonderful concept.
Okay.
I love it.
All right. Well, good.
If you make that happen, I'll love it.
Okay, good. Because I am going to need to earn a living when I'm done with all this.
Okay.
And hopefully I can, you know, make it happen with me.
Yeah.
Which would be awfully nice.
Yes. Well, see, I believe it's individual, and this is what I tell my clients, mm-hmm. use other people, use the OA people.
Yeah.
You don't have to love them. Like I said, I didn't go to coffee. I didn't want to socialize.
Yeah.
You don't have to love them, and you don't have to think they're gods. Just use them to get your own needs met. Chew them up,
uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
So I use the people as I need them, and I keep doing my own thing. Yeah, I'll do it.
Okay,
let me do it because it's weird.
Okay. We're just talking about lifting the blinds, nothing else.
Yeah.
Or the tape. What's your history with exercise?
Oh, very little, very random. I don't recommend a lot of exercise for people who are first losing weight because, you know, just lugging around all that poundage is a lot of good exercise. It really is. But in recent years, because of menopause, you know, and other things, I've tried to speed up my metabolism a little more.
And like I say, I just started on a regular exercise program just recently, but, excuse me, I never did exercise really very rigorously throughout most of my recovery.
Well, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the, you know, the current things is you must exercise.
Yeah, I know. And I say it now for myself, too, but I wouldn't say it for a 30-year-old trying to lose from big weight. Because well, exercising makes you hungry. You know, I tried to keep it really low.
Uh-huh.
And I was traveling around the country. I was very involved with my career, so I didn't really take the time you need to exercise.
Well, I'm also wondering, based on what you just said about, you know, it makes you hungry, and you gestured towards keeping something down, and I'm thinking about... you know, many people resent exercise, especially when they start, and that could be maybe a catalyst to overeating because, A, it makes you hungry, and B, you don't want to do it.
Yes.
And you want a reward.
Yes,
you
right.
Know? So, I mean, that's a simplistic way to put it.
No.
But I think that what you're describing is something that a lot of people experience.
Yes.
It's aversive.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So always, is it something that you can enjoy? Like, you know, I was just doing bike riding and swimming because those are things I like.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I could, I have to go to the market. If I can think, maybe I'll ride my bike over there. It's a half a mile and ride back. That'll be wonderful instead of taking the car. And start out with those kind of little things. Or if walk with a friend. You know, like when people want to meet me for coffee or
mm-hmm.
for dinner,
mm-hmm.
I say, meet me for a walk instead.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go for a walk together and just try to keep the engines moving a little more.
Are you surprised that you say that after a history of not exercising?
Yeah. It's good. It's nice. I'm glad.
How do you motivate yourself?
Well, I don't know that I motivate myself. That sounds like... that I take on a project that I really don't want to do. I motivate myself, what, to lose weight or to what?
Just in general.
Well, I think I am a hedonist, and I think I think I go for what feels good.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrap myself around the good feelings. Like, you know, I love my writing. I really love it, and I avoid it like the plague.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm constantly in a battle with my writing, and then sometimes I just say, by God, you know that if you sit down there in front of that blank screen, by the end of the day, you're going to be high and love it. So I've had that experience enough to know it. The routine kind of office work, I do it, I try to do it in little chunks, you know, and then take a break.
Do you have difficulty transitioning, like, into working, into exercise? You know, if you've been having breakfast and you were planning to go exercise, is it hard to get up and do it?
I don't think so. I'm pretty organized and scheduled kind of a person. I have my ideas of what I should be moving to next. I have a sign up there. It says Dolce Nanya. Dolce far niente, and it means how sweet it is to do nothing. But I have it on a wall there.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying so hard to give myself days like that, little drool, schlub days of sitting around.
Uh-huh.
But I'm very interested in so many things, and I've got so many little projects going that there's always something next.
So how do you balance that?
I guess when I go away with Henry, when we go to third world countries, you know, the phones are off and everything's like, shh, and we're just down to basics. And I haven't found a way to do it in my daily life yet.
Mm-hmm.
My daily life still ends up, I mean, even if it's I'm going to the pool, it's like, okay, let me see if I can finish that, so then I'll have time to get to the pool, the yoga class, I've got to rush to that. I'm still doing that.
Yeah, rushing out of here to go tango.
That's right, yeah. But see, like in tango, I have to be focused on the dance and the music, mm-hmm. and So I guess I don't have trouble transitioning. When I get myself in the next place, I'm fully there. Mm-hmm. I don't take cell phones with me. I don't want to be interrupted when I'm doing one thing. I'm totally in, and that might be helpful in weight loss, by the way. I don't have call waiting so that I can click off that person. I'll finish this conversation, and then I'll listen to voicemail, and I'll get back to that person. I'm not going to be splattered, and it seems like modern culture wants you splattered.
I think some patience is required to do one thing at a time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, the patience to finish a phone call and check your messages.
Yeah.
And return your phone calls.
Well, I just know I can't be nuts like that.
Mm-hmm. How often do you travel?
Maybe every 3 months we go on some kind of a long trip. But then, you know, a couple years ago we were in India for 4 months. We were gone for 4 months, and then other times 3 months, 2 months. This summer we'll probably be gone 2 months. You know, Palm Springs is ideal for that because in the summer you leave because it's very hot, you know.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of people leave during the summer. I'll be here this summer for some of it.
So it sounds like you might have as much as 6 months out of the country.
We could, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
We touched on this. Do you still deal with fear of putting weight back on?
It's very interesting. I think it's coincided with my acceptance of this being my weight that my fear has diminished.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it wasn't a fear like you hear some people in OA talk about. It wasn't like a major fear. I don't think I'm ever going to go back up to there again, but I do see that if I don't watch 2 or 3 pounds creep here or there, and I know that years and years and years of that 2 and 3 will get you back there. But I don't have a fear of that I'm going to binge my brains out and in 6 months put it all back on, which I have been able to do in the past, by the way. I don't think I'm going to have that kind of episode again. I doubt that. But I just do know that, you know, with aging and with the American diet, and that without some kind of vigilance, it's so casual and easy to put it back on,
mm-hmm.
you know. And without even thinking about it, it would just happen quickly. Because I have a natural tendency to be at a higher weight. I know that. So, but I'm not living in any kind of fear like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So quietly vigilant.
Yes. Yeah. I have a respect for what I have to deal with. And you know, even normal people have to deal with it. You know, I remember once watching the Olympic skater after she joined the Ice Capades, Dorothy Hamill.
Mm.
She was on Merv Griffin, and she was saying that she skates 5 hours a day practicing, and then on Friday nights the Ice Capades made her weigh in before she could skate on the weekend show, and if she was overweight she couldn't skate. And I said, now here's a woman of normal weight who's exercising 5 hours a day, and she still has to worry that she's going to be overweight on Friday. I said, if she has to do that, then what am I crying about? You know? I mean, everybody out there. You know, Henry, who's pretty much of a normal person, he watches what he eats. You know? He got the fiber one from the store. You know? Yeah.
Do you feel like your perception of life has changed?
Oh, yeah. They're big time. You know, when Albert Einstein discovered his theory of relativity, so he explained how the universe works. So the reporters all said, okay, Dr. Einstein, now that we know how the universe works, what's the next great question for mankind? He said, well, the next question is the universe friendly? And that, I think, is a flip of the switch. I believe today that the universe is friendly toward me. I believe in the law of nature and survival of the fittest, but I don't believe anyone's out to get me. I may still get got because life is uncertain. so eat dessert first. But that is very different from who I was when I was in my greatest suffering with my obesity. I didn't believe the universe was friendly. People made fun of me. I hated them. They hated me. It was different.
When was that?
Well, before I got into OA, you know, in my... I mean, I had fun and everything, but I felt life was a battle. Mm-hmm. And that I had to, you know, my tombstone was going to read, "Nobody got the best of her." Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. that I had to fight and I had to win. And I had to overcome these evil forces coming at me. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty much my mindset before. And now I don't see it that way. I may still have bad luck and things will turn out wrong in many ways. And I'll suffer more physical deterioration as I get older. But it's not because there's any evil intent toward me.
Mm-hmm. And how did you make that transition in your thinking?
Well, you know, I don't know that I made that transition. It's just, it's like osmosis. It's something that happens to you. You know, surrounding myself with the right kind of energy and the right kind of people, and I believe a lot of it happened for me in OA and AA and those groups. You know, I went to a lot of meetings and I heard different people, and then I guess I stopped fighting as much, mm-hmm. and so the results I got back were less hostile. Mm-hmm. You know, who knows? Chicken or egg, who caused it, and, you know. So,
I love the image of osmosis.
Yes.
And the, you know, that as you start to shift, that allows for more shift.
Yes.
You know, and more positive interaction with people.
That's right. And it's you have to be patient.
Yeah.
And it isn't something that I saw it as a goal. You know, I'm really concerned that all weight loss programs now are about goals. Mm-hmm. Goal weight, goal this, goal that. And I didn't set out to have that kind of a shift in my personality or my life. I think my constant motivation was clarity. Mm-hmm. And in seeking clarity, I put myself in situations where I guess I saw a friendlier universe. You know, the book From Bagels to Buddha starts out in a Buddhist monastery. I took myself there. Mm-hmm. I became a seeker. And I was seeking experiences that raised my consciousness higher. And so I behaved differently and got back differently. Mm-hmm. That changed the men I was dating, you know, my therapist used to say, we choose who we are. And I'd be so angry because I was dating all these no-good-nick guys. And he said, you choose who you are. And, you know, I feel it's a really an indication of how far I've come that I'm with a man like Henry. I mean, he has such integrity and he's so such a fine gentleman. And so I must be that, too.
How long have you been with him?
14 years.
Wow.
He now holds the record,
uh-huh.
the longest.
It's you know, I'm caught by what you say about the goals. You know that I think most people who are dissatisfied with their weight definitely are pushing a goal of one sort or another, and that your goal wasn't specifically about weight; it was clarity.
Well. Yes, but not fully. I mean, initially I came for the weight loss.
Sure.
You know, they say in OA we come for the vanity and stay for the sanity. And I think that's what happened, is even after I lost weight, I realized there was more out there for me to explore than just my body and my image. But, you know, building the inner core that you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And so I stayed a seeker after that, you know, seeking toward that.
Which I think also is part of the, you know, the long-term success that, because, of course, it went into OA for weight.
Yes, yes.
But, you know, they say if you want to be a really good artist or a really good writer or something, you don't imitate the work that you admire, or, you know, the work of the level you want to be. You imitate the work that's way beyond you.
Uh-huh.
You know, you have to go for the bigger picture than you can possibly do to get your portion of it.
Yes.
And that's not exactly what happened, but you went for more than weight loss.
That's right.
You know, you may not have started out that way, but that's what it ended up being.
That's right. You're absolutely right, yeah. So that any program has to incorporate those things in it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to give people a taste of those possibilities, because if it's all about weight loss, they're going to, when they lose the weight, they're going to stop the journey and regain the weight.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I don't know how to understand change or anything about weight loss programs specifically is that a lot of them do try to incorporate this kind of stuff in there. You know, Weight Watchers certainly tries to give you tools for treating yourself more kindly and getting yourself involved in activities and exercise, you know, and cognitive differences. But somehow it's kind of like trying to play with blocks rather than make something whole in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking when I'm listening to your experience. You know, your experience was a very organic one.
Yeah. Also, crises happened in all those years, and I was faced with, you know, for example, you know, when my husband and I broke up and he died, and then I created the nation's first eating disorder unit, and the psychiatrist that I worked for stole it from me, and he developed units all over the country, a very big name, very no-good-nick guy, and people said, oh, you should sue the SOB, you know, and then people in OA said, God doesn't close one door without opening another one, and I said, shut up, you know. But as those crises happened for me, I took refuge. Mm-hmm. I think that's another important thing in Buddhism. They talk about seeking refuge. But I took refuge in surrounding myself like little gerbils with all these other people in these meetings that, you know, the outside world is very threatening for me right now, and I'm very scared. And somehow just the warmth of, well, just keep on keeping on, we're all sitting here, we're all doing our best, you know. When I went for my PhD, you know, I was like before the women's movement. And so the idea of a woman getting a doctorate was very foreign, you know. I thought, my God, I'm already intimidating to men. If I'm a doctor, you know, I'm supposed to marry one, not be one, you know. And then gently in those rooms, you know, the message was, be all that you can be, try your best, begin at once, blah, blah. And eventually I got my PhD.
Where did you go?
USC.
They were gentle?
Where did I go for the comfort and refuge? No, in
OA
meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Why do you say that about USC?
Because I think of it as a fairly competitive school, and certainly in a situation where you're, you know, damn woman pushing your envelope, you know,
uh-huh.
I find it hard to imagine that they would be nurturant.
It was a very good program. I got my master's in rehabilitation counseling. I had a lovely experience. You're right. It was a tough school and very competitive, but I loved it because USC, as opposed to UCLA, UCLA was called the rat psychology school for all the experiments, and USC was very clinically oriented, and I was a great clinician, and so I had it made. It was wonderful because they really valued what my talent was, and so I kind of shone and had a very good experience there. Yeah. From my master's, which was a 2-year master's, it took me 13 more years before I got the PhD. Because I was so busy out there doing this work and developing these treatment centers, I didn't have time to be finishing my dissertation and all the other things, you know. And it was only when this guy stole my treatment centers that I had time in my life to finish my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And then I
rewrote it for a popular audience, and it became the book that is a family affair and became a bestseller, and there you are.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't plan all that.
Mm-hmm.
It just happened, you know?
Yeah. I keep thinking about Al Gore. If he'd been president, what would he have done about the environment? I mean,
yeah.
Instead he wins the Nobel Prize for the environment thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about close the door, open a window.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe that's another thing, is to be on a path where you're going to let your life evolve for you rather than that goal-oriented pushing.
Yeah, that's very difficult. I think especially for Americans, I don't know. It seems like our culture, certainly on the coastal sides,
yes,
is very goal-oriented and very contemptuous of not, you know, open door A, open door B, open
yes.
door C.
Yeah, push. Yeah.
Which makes it hard for people who don't function that way.
Yeah. I know. Well, they just get diagnosed as ADD. That's the new thing. I'm ADD.
Okay. It's always a fad of some sort or another.
Yeah, right.
I have this as a question. We've been talking about it. If you want to add anything to it, have any emotional problems you associated with a heavier weight been solved by your weight loss or around your weight loss?
Well, yeah. You'll see at the bottom of my emails, on my signature line, I say, let it begin with me. And, you know, this sounds very anti-psychology and stuff, but I do believe that most of my problems I created in my life, for good reason, and they were defenses against other problems. But I very much... Just like, you know, when you start focusing on measuring out your one cup of salad or whatever, this is what I can do about it. You know, I remember early on I was sitting down and I was having a big salad and some people were looking at me, you know, because fat people aren't allowed to eat, you know, and they were looking at me like, oh, she's eating such a big salad. And I was able to say to myself, my sponsor and I said I could have this salad, you know.
Uh-huh.
But also... I was saying, you know, I may be fat today, but this is what I'm doing about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing something about it. So the same thing about all the problems that I had in my life that I was investigating throughout my recovery, it always came back to that slogan they say, when one finger's pointing that way, three are pointing back this way, you know, look at yourself. What are you doing? What's your part in it?
Mm-hmm.
So that each time... I had to look at, what am I doing? Yeah, that person's acting hostile to me, but what am I doing that's kind of triggering that?
Mm-hmm.
What part do I have in creating their anger? And why is it that I get into conflicts with men often, powerful men? You know, what is that about? And just constantly, or why... Do I have jealousy things with my girlfriends? Why am I always resentful of my girlfriends having other girlfriends? Or whatever it is. And when I had to keep looking at my own part in it, it changed how I have problems in my life today.
How?
Because I'm not a victim. I'm not... looking at what they're doing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they are. And there are some nasty people, and I choose to stay away from them
mm-hmm.
once I see that.
Mm-hmm.
But I first look at, what am I creating here, and what am I doing? What's my part in it? I recently had a thing where a friend told me that I'm codependent, that I'm helping her too much or giving her advice, and I'm actually judgmental of her. And that is what you are when you're giving advice,
mm-hmm.
isn't it? So, so I'm clearly seeing my part in this and how I have to give up wanting her to do it differently, you know? And that's very big. But when I do that, then I also look at how does she set me up
uh-huh.
by just giving me little woe is me kind of stuff. You know, she'll give me that kind of, and that then that triggers me into going into my helper mode. So now, each time we talk on the phone, when she says, I'm on my way to the doctor, I just stay silent. You know, I'm not going to say my usual and customary little advice-giving, helpful thing, you know? So I've learned a way to try to be aware and then break patterns that are automatic. These automatic patterns you get into with people. Yeah. That they say that and you automatically do that. You know, and they're boring and they're not authentic. They're not at risk. They don't have that flavor of electricity in the air. What are you going to say that's different this time? You know?
Getting back to your taking chances.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm stuck now on the big salad and the people judging and staring.
Yeah.
And,
but you get what I mean when you say, well, I'm doing something about it.
Uh-huh.
Get off my back.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You don't know where I'm coming from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And being able to say that to yourself enough so that you don't let your perception of their perception of you influence your behavior.
Yeah. Well, see, that's what, when I think having that sponsor was good.
Uh-huh.
You know, the support of, I remember when people used to say, Fatty, when I was a little girl, and they'd sing, Fatty, Fatty, 2x4, can't get through the bathroom door. So she did it on the floor, licked it up and did some more. Ha ha. And I would be mortified, and I would leave my body, and I would be thinking about, there are people at home who'd feel really bad if they saw you doing this to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I couldn't let myself feel bad, mm-hmm. but I could feel bad for my parents who would feel bad if they saw those people doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the same thing there sitting in that restaurant. Okay, all you people can be giving me your looks, but my sponsor and I have discussed this salad, and this is my plan now. This is actually my medicine to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm entitled to have this large bowl, you know? I still eat a large vat of salad every day at lunch. Henry says, I don't see how you could eat all that.
I said, shut up. Do you use dressing on it?
Yeah, but I usually make my own dressings.
Uh-huh.
I don't like bottled dressings because they're either high fat or high sugar or both. And they're not as satisfying.
What kind of dressings do you make?
Oh, God. I do one that has yeast flakes in it. It's really good. And I make a peanut dressing for sesame, you know, for Asian stuff. And the Moosewood Cookbook has a lot of good dressings in it. And different things I try. And then I modify them. I use canola oil or more water and make them less fattening.
Mm-hmm. What emotional triggers, if any, still tempt you back to old habits? If any.
Well, let me see. I guess in the holiday season, that whole social chit-chat networking kind of thing of standing around making small talk. I'm just not good at small talk. And it seems like most of the small talk today, at least with strangers, is people showing off and advertising their thing, you know. And I always have this strange feeling of like, what am I doing here? And to overcome that feeling, I go to taking another hors d'oeuvre, you know. And it can be crap I don't even like. But I just, and so it's hard to be in those situations. I mean, I should just stay away and not even go to them.
Mm-hmm.
I was just at one last night and one earlier in the week, and, you know, everybody's just standing around being so sophisticated and networking.
So it's sort of a combination business pleasure thing?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess so, yeah, those things. But emotional triggers, I'm trying to think. There aren't, you know, the truth is that I've removed those people from my life who are catalysts in that way. I've really refined my life to people that don't trigger me.
A question I don't have here, but you're making me think about it, is depression and anxiety are two very common things associated with weight issues. Did you experience them? Do you still experience them?
Well, I've always said that eating was our treatment for our depression. So I think we're all depressed with good reason. And I was depressed on and off for different years. I think it hits worst in the second year of recovery. The first 2 years are focused mainly on getting the weight off, and there's a high about the success of that. And actually, in alcoholism, we found that at 2 and 5 years were the strongest relapse times. And that's also true in cancer. You know, having a lifelong chronic illness, if you have 2 years gone out of it, that looks good. 5 years, even better. So at 2 years, I went into therapy for myself, even though I'd had a lot of work on myself in graduate school and in my internship hours. But I went into therapy, and I stayed in therapy on and off for about 22 years. And I always said it was, you know, for my work, for my clients, which it was, you know, because I wanted to keep my own channel clear. But I needed it. I remember when I first saw this guy, the first session, he was a great therapist for me, but the first session he said to me, "You're going to be a long-term client." And I said, "How do you know that?" I wanted to say, "How the hell do you know that? You know, how dare you?"
Yeah.
But he was right. I had a lot to work through and overcome. And I'm grateful for every penny of the billions of dollars I paid. But it was a worthwhile experience.
Did you ever use psychotropic drugs?
Never. No. And my experience working in the treatment field is that they cause more problems than they solve. And I really was against them when I had treatment centers, because I said, look, we're bringing this person into an environment where they can flip out and fall apart, where you can put them in a padded cell and let them freak out and find out the worst of what's there. Why would now be the time you put them on a drug? But, of course, the insurance company said it's cheaper that way. You know, we'll get them in and out of the hospital real fast. But I wanted them to use it as a breakdown place.
Yeah.
You know, the one of my Buddhist teachers said that the The psychotic is swimming. The psychotic is drowning in the same water where the mystic is swimming. And, you know, we need a place where we can face our greatest fears and then rise to our greatest good. And medical treatment isn't offering that today. And all of these drugs are, you know, they don't tell you the side effects. And then you have a long time getting off them. They're a lot more addictive than people think. So I'm grateful that I never got into them. And I know some people need them. But I think a lot fewer need them than how it's going these days.
Okay. Were you ever suicidal?
Yes. In college, I was once going to commit suicide because a man jilted me, and it was pretty bad. And it went away because I was sitting in a coffee shop. I was a waitress, and I was sitting looking out the window, and there was this great tree in front of the window, and I started thinking about photosynthesis and the chlorophyll and all this stuff I had just learned in biology. And I said, man, there's so much to learn in the world. Why would I kill myself?
Cool.
And that was the end of that.
Fabulous.
Yeah, so that was the only time I'd ever thought of that.
Were you aware when you got all your weight off at OA that this time it was going to stick?
No. No, not at all. In fact, I told you it's only been 2 or 3 years ago that I really got the sense that it's going to stick. No, all the rest of the time I never I never knew for sure. You know, I hoped and I prayed and I kept dealing with it, but I never thought that, you know, I'm a normie.
So for 30 years, you've lived with uncertainty. Because you started at 30, 29 and a half.
Yeah.
And in the 2 years, it was off.
Yes.
And you're 64 now, and a couple years ago, you started to have a sense.
Yes. Really?
That's
sad, isn't it?
I don't think so.
No?
Actually, I think it's hopeful.
Why?
Because you were able to live with it.
Oh, to live knowing that I might...
To live with uncertainty.
You're right. Yes, you're right. Yeah. No, I was thinking how sad that it took 30 years before I'm finally feeling comfortable that this is true.
Yeah.
That who I am today is the true self.
But maybe if you had felt comfortable, it wouldn't have been true.
That's right. I might have put it all back on. Yeah. Because I think that's what happens is that people relax their vigilance about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see why. I mean, who wants to pay attention to this?
Well, this is one of the reasons that I was looking for a long time maintainer.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I've had half of the time trying to find people who are 5 years or more out.
Yeah.
Because.
Now, this lady, they told me that last week a woman spoke at that meeting who had lost 30 pounds.
30?
I mean, 30 years.
Oh, yeah. I recruited her.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, what's her name? Because they said she mentioned my name, that she came through treatment with me.
Gail?
I don't know. Well, anyway, if you have my number, and
yeah.
If you meet with her, tell her I'd like her to call me.
I will be meeting with her next week, actually.
Okay, because I would really like,
okay.
I'd really like to just, you know, reunite with her. Because mm-hmm. someone called me and said this gal mentioned that she came into your treatment center and you were she heard you speak and she mentioned.
I was at that meeting. I don't remember that off the top of my head,
oh, really?
But I will certainly ask her.
Okay.
Because, you know, everyone remembers different people.
Maybe it was the year before or the speaker the week before or something.
Yeah, I was there on Sunday, but I wasn't there the 2 weeks prior to that.
Well, this guy said it was Sunday.
Okay.
So we'll see.
We'll see.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gail was her.
Okay.
What was different from previous weight loss experiences?
I think the focus on that weight loss will be the byproduct, that the primary focus is on developing your own personhood
mm-hmm.
and taking a look at yourself. And the byproduct will be the weight loss in God's good time, mm-hmm. whatever that is. I never believed in God, even though there's supposedly a lot of God talk in OA. I still don't have that sense of a God. But the idea that you approach it sideways. You don't go full frontal. It's not a weight loss program.
Mm-hmm.
It's a self-improvement program and a spiritual program. And so you want to keep the food in order so that you're available for that work.
That's a nice way to put it.
Yeah. That was the message I got
uh-huh.
that was very different than any other time before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not focusing on the food. The food is keeping your focus off of the other stuff.
Exactly, yeah. So that you would make a certain plan just to have it out of the way.
Uh-huh.
So that was no longer an issue.
Uh-huh.
So I wouldn't have to go to that party and debate, will I or won't I have that canopy?
Mm-hmm.
It's not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in later years, it's been a little more relaxed, and so that becomes an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, the vigilance has to remain, even though you feel comfortable with yourself. You understand, you know, that you're vulnerable.
Yes. I think I like to say it's a healthy respect.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't gain all that weight by accident. I dieted my way to 222 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I say.
Yeah.
And so I just have to realize that it does have a certain power over me. And God knows our whole country now, you can see it's got everybody. So I want to be...
And yet we're still very hostile towards it.
Exactly. Isn't that unbelievable?
The population is overweight. And
yes.
All,
yeah. Yeah, and there's still this judgment, like you should have done something. See, that's where it's different from the other alcohol and the other things. You don't see these ads on TV saying, we've got a quick and easy way for you to cure your alcoholism. You know, read this book or buy this exercise contraption. Mm-hmm. And because there's so much of that out there, that's why then there's this judgment is, why'd you do that to yourself? Mm-hmm. Dummy, you should be smart enough to buy that contraption and it wouldn't happen.
For some reason, being heavy is a moral failing.
Right.
I mean, just being an alcoholic is also a moral failing, you know, but
yeah.
Since it's less visible. You know, if you're not caught drinking.
But alcoholism has now been accepted as a disease for the most part.
Yeah.
And so there's a certain amount of compassion that people have toward alcoholics that they don't have toward overeaters.
Yeah, there's a lot of hatred.
There really is. And I think it's fear because everybody knows they have the tendency to be that way. Mm-hmm. That's why the whole treatment field now has been taken over by centers that just want to treat anorexics and vomiters. Mm-hmm. They don't want to treat the obese. Mm-hmm. Why? Because anorexics and vomiters you can hold at arm's length and you can say, look at this aberrant behavior. I don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But overeating? Everybody overeats. Mm-hmm. So the clinician doesn't know how to treat it because they're just a couple meals away, you know, from crossing that line. And so they say, oh, do I have to look at my eating behavior if I want to be honest with this person? And the answer is yes. but you don't have to be fanatic. But there's not much teaching moderation and easy does it and all the things that...
It's like, I mean, fat is a dirty word.
Yeah.
And I think that... Although lip service is paid to moderation, you know, especially in programs like Weight Watchers, they recommend, you know, you don't lose more than a pound or two a week.
Uh-huh.
Like you have a choice.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I think the tacit message is you get the weight off, fatty.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's very judgmental. I know.
And you know, one of the things that I wonder about in terms of treating people who are obese is how to do it, because you don't want, I'm not even sure I have the words for it, but you're talking about it, about staying out of the arena. You know, when you're, what you were saying before about the codependency with the friends, where, you know, when you're giving advice, you're judgmental.
Yeah.
We all are judgmental when we're giving advice. And there's something about that to me in trying to work with somebody who's trying to lose weight. That there's something about the judgment that kind of goes unacknowledged between the parties.
Yes, you're right. Very good. Yeah. Yes. And how much of that needs to be addressed?
Elephant in the room.
Yeah, very much, yeah.
You're really helping me here. Thank you.
Really?
Yeah.
About what?
Well, this is spurring my... First of all, it's informational. And secondly... You know, we are being very collaborative here in terms of you are helping me think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm liking talking with you, too, very much. Yeah, it's been very beneficial.
That's why I wanted to do qualitative, because, you know, I'm not into, and one of my committee is the school statistician, so I'm sorry about this, but I'm not into, you know, the concrete, discrete data point.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, I'm not that good at it. But
aside
from that,
yeah.
You know, this subject seems to be so fluid.
It is,
And because we have evidence that there isn't a cure, because the best statistic about keeping weight off is 20%.
Really?
There is actually a 20% statistic through the National Weight Control Registry, Rena Wing and James Hill and Susan Phelan. And they have about 5,000 people in it, but I also think that that's, you know, 20% is not necessarily everybody there. But, you know, most of the statistics are like 2-3% of the people who lose weight keep it off.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if 20% is accurate, that's not a high percentage.
No, it's not.
If you're doing open heart surgery and you have a 20% success rate, you know, you kiss that person goodbye.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
So, So, this is really the last question. What do you think helped the most?
Helped the most?
Yeah.
Or helped?
Well, you know what?
Both. Well, the idea of just getting back on the horse, you know, I'm very opposed to people counting days in OA, though I think if it motivates newcomers to feel enthused, fine. But, you know, the idea that there'll be good days and bad days and the ebb and flow idea about stuff and the no matter what idea is sometimes very helpful, you know, that you don't eat no matter what. That, you know, there are always good reasons to say, well, this made me and that made me and I had to because of this and that. Or no matter what, this is a normal portion and this is what my body needs and I will, hell or high water, eat just what my body needs. And if I have to call 12 people and write volumes and masturbate 5 times a day or whatever it takes, I'll do whatever it takes not to take that next bite. I think that's an important...
So how do you get there? How did you get to no matter what?
I don't know. I don't know that there's an answer.
I think you have been telling me.
Okay.
But I'm trying to cheat a little bit and see if you can come up with, you know, like a direct link
to
something.
Yes. I know that when, you know, when I was 29 and a half years old and I said, dear God, the next 30 have to be different, I said no matter what. I said, nothing, I'll do whatever it takes not to have to deal with this like this for the rest of my life over and over and over again. So I guess the idea we know how hard it is, you know, of realizing it's going to be hard and I'm going to have to go through a lot without my best friend. Everything I did before, I did with my best friend. Now I have to do it turning to others, which aren't as good as my best friend. And
best friend being food.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I guess the most important thing is that recognition of how hard it is instead of all that easy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a big thing. And then as I started, and then really appreciating the secondary gains you're getting from doing it. Like I said, you know, clarity in decision making and other ways of feeling better about yourself because of what you're doing. Those should be valued,
mm-hmm.
even if the poundage isn't showing up the same way,
mm-hmm.
you know. But that those are important things to have in life, those benchmarks. Today, I think I've incorporated kind of a way of having food have its proper place in my life. I'm still not like a normie. I'm still not like many of the men I've known who said, oh, I don't know, I wasn't hungry, I skipped lunch, or, you know, people who say, oh, I don't know what I'm going to have for dinner. And there's a lot of those kind of people. I still have a plan, basically, every day, you know. This will be breakfast, this will be lunch, this will be dinner, more or less. But it's not the all-consuming important thing that it was.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't actually do it, it's not a destroyer.
No, it's just to have a kind of vague plan and then see how you measure up. But, it, you know, they say failing to plan is planning to fail. So just leaving it casually, like what's in the refrigerator and that sort of stuff can get me picking.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be a picky because I'll always eat more than what I need, you know.
So.
Cool.
Yeah. This has been great. I love it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm going to turn this off. If anybody's listening to this and want to talk to me, call me at 1-800-8-ENOUGH.
I'm off this now.
Okay. I'm turning mine off.
Okay.
1-800-8-ENOUGH.
I have an hour and 20